Tonight's program to the struggling freedom fighters of the Gaza Strip and Zimbabwe and Somalia and all of the inmates of the poverty-based imperial prison systems throughout the world. So stay tuned for Agenda and journey into the land of struggle with Liberation Radio, guaranteed not to be heard on any commercial radio station. And as always, we stand ready for the revolution.
Hotep, this is Sister Arissa with Freedom Now's Agenda for this Tuesday, August 4th, 2009. Freedom Now will cover four themes tonight. In commemoration of Black August, the Raising the Bar segment will have an interview with Karima El Amin, an attorney and the husband of Jamil El Amin, formerly H. Rock Brown, a political prisoner and a major civil rights, Black Power, an Islamic leader in the U.S. We will follow with Didon and the African Drumbeat Historical Calendar. Brother Obi Egbuna, a journalist with the Zimbabwe Herald, will update us on the United Front in Zimbabwe. This front, initiated by African neighboring governments, threatens the Bush-Obama objective of a Mugabe regime change. The capitalist power's objective here is to halt the land redistribution program from the rich European landowners who stole the land during colonization. ZANU, the ruling party, has been about the task of redistributing the land to the indigenous people of Zimbabwe. Continuing, Minister Paul Scott will deconstruct Lil Wayne, the rapper, who is the latest and most visited internet sensation with a rap song entitled Whipping It Like a Slave, a self-hating metaphoric assault against African people, switching between physical slavery and promoting crack chemical enslavement. We will close out with the former Georgia Congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate, Cynthia McKinney, who has been targeted through military assault and imprisonment for her and a group of humanitarians, activists, efforts to get medical supplies and toys to the besieged people of Gaza. She has been active in sabotaging the Israel and the U.S. efforts to destabilize the democratic elected government of Gaza. Our music mix will include Zap Mama, Fele Kuti, Gigi All-Star Dub, Malunia Noor, Lil Wayne, Heartaches, and The Temptations, with clips from H. Rap Brown and The Ravaging of Africa. So stay tuned, and if you want to be informed of future programs, please call us at 323-646-4814, and we will include you in our text messaging. Remember, tonight's and prior programs can be reheard and downloaded by going to kpfk.org, audio archives, and scroll to Freedom Now, or just drop us a line at freedomnow@kpfk.org and give us some constructive criticism. We thank you for our love and support. And as always, we stand ready for the revolution.
by the politicians of the white power structure. They recognize that if they can get black people thinking culturally, they don't have to worry about them moving politically. If it can become sufficient to be black and proud, then you don't have to worry about the oppression that grips black people. To be black will become ego-gratifying. In other words, black people will form a cult, and it will be nothing else but black and proud, and they will boogaloo to the concentration camps when the man chooses to send them there.
Yeah, we'd like to welcome to our studio Brother Matef and Sister Karima El-Amin, the wife and attorney for Brother Jamil Al-Amin, formerly Rap Brown. We just heard a clip from Brother Rap, my sister. Welcome to Southern California.
Thank you very much.
Brother Matef, raising the bars once again.
Yes, tonight we're more than honored to have Sister Karima Al-Amin on the line. While most of us would know her because of her marriage to the Imam, the former H. Rap Brown, Sister Karima deserves recognition in her own right. Since 1997, Sister Karima has practiced law in Georgia. Her practice focuses on immigration, personal injury, family, and business law. She also serves as legal counsel for several community organizations and businesses. Sister Karima is a member of several legal organizations, including the American Immigration Lawyers Association and the Georgia Association of Muslim Lawyers. In addition to her private practice, Sister Karima continues to work with attorneys in appealing her husband's conviction. Now, I know there are youth in our audience who will not remember Imam Jamil Al-Amin, who is currently a political prisoner in the federal Supermax prison at Florence, Colorado. As a teen, he became an organizer for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. At 23, he became chair of SNCC, and the very next year became Minister of Justice for the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. I remember the Imam, because of his fiery speech, and he was on the FBI's most wanted list for just starting a riot simply by speaking at a rally. After his capture, he converted to Islam while inside. On the outside, he became a community leader, helped rid his neighborhood of crime with pro-human programs of uplift. But in 2000, as a result of a COINTELPRO operation, the state accused him of killing one police officer and wounding another outside his own grocery store. His conviction carried a life sentence without parole. But because he continued his spiritual and community activities inside, the state had to try to shut him up by moving him to a supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. Now, with that very short update, we're most excited to welcome Sister Karima, Hotep sister.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the program to share some information. In fact, I just returned from Florence, Colorado, seeing my husband. So this program, or my being on the program, is timely.
Now, when you go inside, explain what is it like in a supermax, because I know we've talked about this before, but for some reason people just don't get it.
Right. A supermax prison is a no-touch, no-contact facility. The purpose of it is to just strip inmates of all rights, all human dignity. It is tantamount to torture. When we talk about waterboarding can take many forms. And just to have an inmate not be able to even speak to a human is just absolutely deplorable. The conditions are horrible. In fact, my husband, in order for the federal prison to isolate him, they have him doing his recreation in a bubble. So he is not even around other human beings while he's there.
Now, please explain to our audience, why should we be concerned about this? Because folk are saying, well, you know, he's in with the worst of the worst. He must be one of the worst himself.
Well, you know, I think you said it during your introduction. He was placed on the most on the 10 most wanted list in 1970 just for not appearing for trial. And the charges then were based on his speech that he made in Cambridge, Maryland.
Yeah.
In 1968, the Congress enacted what was called the Rap Brown Federal Anti-Riot Act, which made it a felony carrying 5 years to just speak and get an audience excited. That law is still on the books. And even when they arrested my husband in 1960, they dusted off some of the charges and some of the acts and some of the rules that they had, and they brought out an Al Capone charge on him. So he was a target in 1967 under the COINTELPRO program, and his being in the federal supermax without any federal charges, he does not have a federal conviction or sentence. But Georgia gave him up to the Federal Bureau of Prisons because they said that he was having too much influence within the Georgia prison system among other inmates.
It's so sad to me because you and I would say it was a positive influence. Other prisoners wrote letters, not just people on the outside. People on the inside wrote letters asking the state of Georgia to keep him in the general population because of the positive influence for peace and for spiritual guidance that he had on the prisoners.
Right, and as a result of, we feel that his transfer out to Florence, Colorado, in addition to his being held in administrative isolation in Georgia and then being moved to the supermax, it's part of just a retaliatory action on the part of Georgia. And we do have a lawsuit in to challenge not only the transfer but the continuation of the inhumane conditions. We're not only concerned about my husband. We're concerned about all inmates that are being held in any facility that is designed to just absolutely rip them of everything. There are so many articles, and I think people need to be aware of the articles on the effect that isolation and supermax prisons have, the effect that it has on inmates and on human beings, and that's what our concern is, that either if they emerge from the prison, they'll either be in a catatonic state or in a state of rage, and so we are concerned about everyone being held in supermax.
Now, sister, other than the lawsuits, what is the plan to help get the imam out, and how can our listeners join into that plan?
Right. Our short-term goal, naturally, is to get him transferred, to get him out of isolation, and naturally, if we can, you know, in a facility where he can be among the general population. Our long-term plan and effort is to get him released right after the incident in March 2000. There was an individual who confessed to it. After 9 years, we finally got another team of attorneys to investigate this, and we're moving forward with our habeas in Georgia to bring that about. We also won what we call a legal mail case. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the state of Georgia, the Reidsville prison, violated my husband's First Amendment right by opening up my legal mail to him.
Yeah.
That was a victory, and we're waiting either to go to trial on that or to receive a settlement on that. So we do have lawsuits. We encourage people. Naturally, we still have a lot of legal costs and expenses. We tell people to go ahead, and you can Google by putting in either Imam Jamil Al-Amin or H. Rapp Brown, and there are sites that will come up that will give people information. And we encourage people to write to my husband. And I think just to let him know that he has not been forgotten. Many people who are in positions that they are now in, they're in mm-hmm. those positions as a result of my husband's work and others who not only worked in the South in SNCC and other organizations, but many who died trying to correct the wrongs. So I think the youth need to be aware of this, and we encourage people to just investigate and read. And then if they care to write him, if they care to donate, the information also is on the internet.
Could you please pass on to your husband our love and our support for him from KPFK and from Southern California, my sister?
Thank you.
We thank you very much, my sister. And we'll post up on our website at kpfk.org under Programs Freedom Now the contact information to communicate as well as provide support to Imam Jamil Alameen. We thank you very much, my sister.
Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Alafia, this is Brother Didon Kamati with this August 4th edition of the African Drumbeat Historical Calendar of significant events and role models in humanity's struggle against all forms of exploitation by the ruling classes and dominant ethnicities. August 4th, 1914, the start of the first imperialist World War I, when Germany invades Belgium. European workers and peasants are massacring each other over the European ruling class efforts to seize control of the colonies of Africa and Asia from each other. August 5th, 1960. Burkina Faso, formerly Upper Volta, becomes independent. Burkina Faso is the home of the world's largest Pan-African film festival, FESPACO. Burkina Faso also was the basis for Thomas Sankara, a revolutionary Pan-Africanist socialist who leads the country against French neocolonialism. August 5th, 1895, Frederick Engels crosses over. Engels was a German social scientist and philosopher, and one of the two founders of the European communist theory, alongside with Karl Marx. Together they produced the Communist Manifesto, the driving book for the Third World and socialist revolutionaries since 1850. His second most important pamphlet, The Origins of the Family, Private Property, and the State, critically looks at the evolution of the nuclear family, private property, and estate as a result of the rise of private ownership, which is the fundamental basis for capitalism. August 6, 1964, the Mississippi Freedom and Democratic Party was founded by SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, to challenge the Democratic Party's stranglehold on the African people in the rural South. In Mississippi, many counties were primarily African, yet the Democratic Party catered to the white minority population, which gave rise to the need for an independent political party. August 6, 1945, the United States drops atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. The U.S. had decoded Japanese messages and knew that they were about to surrender. Japan became a testing ground, as presently Iraq, Somalia, and Afghanistan are, for the United States military industrial complex to test weapons of mass destruction on real population. The U.S. was the first country in the world to use weapons of mass destruction back in 1945. August 6, 1676, Retamu was born. She was a Pocasset Indian of the First Nations of Indigenous People of the present state of Rhode Island. She commanded 300 warriors and as a skilled military leader and fighter led the struggle against the British in the King Philip Wars of Conquest of Native Lands. August 8, 1960, President Kwame Nkrumah Osagyefo of Ghana and Patrice Lumumba of the Congo signed a secret agreement pledging mutual support and uniting and calling for the United States of Africa, with the Congo and Ghana being the first African countries in modern times to unite. Subsequently, George Bush Sr., who was a CIA covert operation director, led to the coup d'etat of the democratically elected governments, paving the way for the Bush dynasty in the U.S. August 8, 1879, revolutionary hero of Mexico Emiliano Zapata was born in Morelos. He campaigned for the rights of peasants over the large landowners. He became the commander of the Peasant Liberation Armies of the South, while Pancho Villa became the commander of the Armies of the North. The liberation movement in Mexico today, for instance, the EZLN, or the Zapatista Army of National Liberation in Chiapas, takes their anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist ideas from this personage. In 1969, Lumumba Zapata University was founded at the University of California, San Diego, where degrees in Third World Studies were provided. August 8, 1449, Portuguese slaver Henry the Navigator delivers 6 ships of human cargo, prisoners of war, or slaves to the European world power of Portugal. August 8, early 18th century. Sister Nana Griggs, a literate Barbadian African freedom fighter, on the Simmons Plantation in the Caribbean, organized a militant corps of slaves which were linked to similar groups throughout the island. This militant, led by Sister Nana, led a slave rebellion that was briefly successful. August 9, 1956, 20,000 African women marched in Pretoria, South Africa, to protest laws forcing them to carry passports, a tactical action in an overall struggle for the liberation of South Africa from settler colonialism, which was led by women. August 9, 1966, the Chinese Communist Party launches a cultural revolution to purge China of the remaining feudal and European cultural and ideological legacies, which break their continued march towards socialism and becoming a world power. This has been a brief overview of some of the historical struggles of Africans and other oppressed against all forms of exploitation, whether slavery, feudalism, capitalism, or imperialism. We should gain strength and motivation from this historical truism that whenever there is oppression, there is resistance. Today, the twin evils of the United States and Israeli imperialism and all forms of settler colonialism are our newest targets, and as with all empires, they are inevitably bound to collapse. Join us in the Freedom Chant of Amandla Awetu, which means the power belongs to we the people. Amandla
Awetu.
Amandla
Awetu.
Amandla
Awetu.
The ravaging of Africa has been enriching Europe and North America for more than 500 years.
First, European empires imposed slavery and colonialism on the continent.
After 1945, the United States took over as the dominant neo-colonial power.
Through the Pentagon and the CIA, the U.S. government has fueled 14 wars in Africa.
It is American invasion, but the U.S. role is everything.
The U.S. has used the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to systematically demolish African economies and health and education sectors.
Par les stratégies de la Banque mondiale, les pauvres seront toujours pauvres, les riches seront toujours riches.
This military and economic war enables the looting of Africa's resources by Western multinational corporations.
Shell is into the politics of Nigeria, you know. We might say we have our independence, but economically, we are still being colonized.
Washington's genocidal imperial strategy has killed more than 26 million Africans, but failed to suppress popular resistance.
We have refused to die. We are living for Africa. No matter what they do, no matter what power they have.
Yeah, we'd like to welcome Obi Egbuna, a journalist in the United States for the Zimbabwe Herald, who will update us on the United Front in Zimbabwe. Brother Obi, welcome to Southern California.
How you doing?
Oh, great, brother.
Always
what's up with the United Front? I know that United States and England in particular are shocked that this United Front appears to be working because, of course, they want regime change.
Definitely. I can give an overview on some things. As people may know or may not know, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and her British counterpart, David Miliband, are about to visit the southern region of Africa for the purpose of trying to continue to influence and undermine the unity government in Zimbabwe. They're going to be bringing up what's going on right now, where you've had 5 members of the parliament that represent MDCT, Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's faction of MDC, who are right now up on fraud charges, and 2 who have been convicted, one of them, Shua Madiwa, has been jailed for 7 years for kidnapping a 12-year-old girl, and Ernest Mudavaunu, the Zaka North House of Assembly representative, who has been sentenced to 1 year in jail for abusing farm subsidies that are part of the food program of the government. And recently, the Tsvangirai faction of MDC appealed to Jacob Zuma, the president of South Africa, who at least for the next few weeks will also be chairing his leadership of SADC, South Africa's leadership of the Southern African Development Community. It's winding down. and they want intervention in the unity government situation. But President Zuma has said that he sees no need for intervention. The two issues that they've been bringing up for the last 4.5 months have been President Mugabe maintaining that Dr. Gideon Gono should be the president of the remain president of the Reserve Bank, and Johannes Tabata be the attorney general. And also, this is interesting because when you look at Zuma, you heard all last year the rumblings of an internal dispute in the ANC between Jacob Zuma and former South African President Thabo Mbeki. But in terms of internal dynamics and relationship to ANC South Africa, but the one thing that stood out clear was that Zuma and Mbeki stood shoulder to shoulder on the question of Zimbabwe.
Right on.
President Zuma has said continuously that the reason that Zimbabwe is in the situation that they're in is because the United States and Britain reneged on the promises made during the Lancaster House negotiations, and he felt that President Mugabe and ZANU-PF had no choice but to do what they did, which was to reclaim the land for the masses of our people. And as we know, former South African President Thabo Mbeki was the one who was appointed by the SADC Collective to mediate what ended up being the unity government that you were talking about. The other crucial dynamic in relationship to the unity government that our brothers and sisters inside U.S. borders need to know is that this is just a continuation of Zimbabwe's commitment to unity. It was a patriotic united front that liberated the country through a 14-year protracted armed struggle. 7 years after independence, there was a unity accord formed between ZANU and ZAPU, and former late Vice President Joshua Nkomo, that's when you had one government that was created and you had one political party that determined the country's destiny. So unity has always guided the struggle in Zimbabwe. I want to end by talking about a personal experience I had about 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. I happened to be in the White House for the photo op between President Barack Obama and Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. And what happened at that photo op was before that took place, President Obama had passed the word down through the State Department apparatus that him or Prime Minister Tsvangirai would not be available to engage the press on developments in Zimbabwe. And I found out later on, about an hour later, that the Minister of Tourism and Hospitality, Minister Walter Mzimbi, who was President Mugabe's representative on that unity government delegation that did not just come to the United States, went to Brussels, went to the Netherlands, went to Germany, and went to the UK as the unity government's first step to begin re-engagement with the West. Minister Mzimbi was banned from coming to the White House, and based on the makeup and composition of the delegation, he would have not had a conversation with President Obama. He would have simply observed the photo op and observed the remarks exchanged between Prime Minister Tsvangirai and President Obama. And it becomes clear that when President Obama says he has as much of a knowledge about the African continent as the presidents who came before him, and that he feels that we have used colonialism and neocolonialism and corruption as an excuse for Africa's stagnation, as it shows that when we discuss African issues, President Obama, when discussing African issues, rather, he's like a fish out of water. And it's very important for your listeners to know that 48 hours before the election back in November, his Africa advisor during the campaign, Whitney Schneidman, who used to work for the Clinton administration, met with all 54 African ambassadors in the United States through their mechanism called the Africa Ambassadors Group. And he informed them that they should not expect any significant change in Africa in terms of how Obama would look at Africa versus how George Bush looked at Africa. And that's very important for people to know. And we see that through this unity government process, at that photo op at the White House, he referred to Prime Minister Tsvangirai as his partner in determining the outcome of Zimbabwe, which means he does not acknowledge the unity government, and he's just as committed to regime change in Zimbabwe as President George W. Bush was. And I've referenced on your show before, and will continue to do so, that on March 15, 2007, he wrote a letter to Bush urging him not to lift the sanctions on Zimbabwe until the dark cloud of Robert Mugabe was ousted from power. And as your listeners probably remember from the last time I was on, in March he used his executive order to extend the sanctions on Zimbabwe. So the $73 million that he sent to Zimbabwe in humanitarian aid will be funneled through the non-governmental organizations. And this was a recommendation that was made by the former U.S. Secretary for African Affairs, Jindai Frazier, saying continue to funnel money through Zimbabwe through these NGOs or do it in the ministries that MDC Shangri controls. And that's very interesting because, as you know, Parade magazine came out with their usual 10 worst dictators list back in March, and they declared President Mugabe the worst dictator in the world. And they said that ZANU-PF has strong-armed all of the key ministries in the country, but how do they explain that the Ministry of Finance is controlled by MDC? The Ministry of Education, Sports, and Culture is controlled by MDC. The Ministry of Health is controlled by MDC. So we see the fraudulent reporting going on to sway people from understanding what goes on. But like I said before also, Secretary of State Clinton lifted the travel alert on Zimbabwe, which prior to April of this year said verbatim, non-essential travel to Zimbabwe for U.S. citizens should be deferred due to violence, where in South Africa, right next door in Johannesburg, 30 people a day die from gun-related crimes, which sounds like South Central Los Angeles, which sounds like Washington, D.C. in the 1980s, but this is the biggest beneficiary of tourism in the United States. But what we need to see happen is President Obama must be pressured not only to lift sanctions on Zimbabwe, but he must engage President Mugabe. I personally feel that by sitting face-to-face with President Mugabe, it will make up for the conversations that he didn't get to have with his own biological father, where he could get a first-hand account of the impact that British colonialism and British imperialism has had on the African continent. So it's very important for us to understand what is at stake, very important for us in the African community to step up and push for the lifting of these sanctions, to be in harmony with the rest of Southern Africa, to be in harmony with the African Union, to be in harmony with the non-aligned movement, and to be in harmony with all freedom-loving people. And we need many people to step up to the plate and raise this question. We know that the Congressional Black Caucus failed miserably on this issue. I just finished interviewing Donald Payne about a month and a half ago, and he was saying that the sanctions are not that much of a big deal. And he was saying that the future of Zimbabwe will be determined by human rights, democracy, giving the usual justification because he was the key member in Congress who pushed the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act through Congress. And we're well aware that Cynthia McKinney, the late Stephanie Tubbs Jones, former Black Panther Bobby Rush, Corin Brown of Florida, and Carolyn Kilpatrick abstained from the vote. We wish that they would have voted against the sanctions. 9 white Republicans voted no, 2 white Democrats voted no, and we congratulate Cynthia McKinney for her courageous stand with the Palestinian people, but we want to let her know tonight there's unfinished business on the question of Zimbabwe, and getting those sanctions lifted against Zimbabwe is very important, and we want her to begin to lend her voice uncompromisingly to dealing with this issue. And Zimbabwe must become for the African what Palestine is for Arabs and Muslims, and what Cuba and Venezuela are for Latin Americans, an issue that no matter where we are in the world, we can rally around, because it speaks to every aspect of our history, every aspect of our suffering, every aspect of our resistance, every aspect of our development.
Well, my brother, what we're going to try to do is facilitate a dialogue between you and Sister Cynthia McKinney, but we thank you very much. And if people want to contact you, how can they contact you?
They can contact me a couple of ways. They can email palo02@yahoo.com, or they can email me at obiegbuna15@yahoo.com. If they want to call, they can call 240-460-0188, and we will continue to, and they can go to OB Egbuna on Zimbabwe to look at the articles. And I should have published by next week the interview that I did with Congressman Donald Payne on the issue of Zimbabwe. And we need everyone, write your congresspeople in that Los Angeles area that voted in favor of these sanctions on Zimbabwe. Let's get it lifted. Let's be masters of our own destiny once and for all.
Chimurenga.
You always.
Chimurenga, brother.
I'm burying it, Chimurenga.
Forward, forward.
Okay.
I wake up in the morning, take a shit, shower, shave, stand over the stove and whip it like a slave. I whip it like a slave, whip it like a slave. Stand over the stove and whip it like a slave. I wake up in the morning, take a shit, shower, shave, stand over the stove and whip it like a slave. I whip it like a slave, I whip it like a slave. Stand over the stove and whip it like a slave. I wake up in the morning, take a shit, shower, shave, stand over the stove and whip it like a slave. I whip it like a slave. Whip it like a slave. Stand over the stove and whip it like a slave.
Okay, new day, new yay. Bet I whip it like Kunta Kinte. Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to bring on our brother minister, Paul Scott. We just heard from Lil Wayne, the rapper, who's, I guess, most visited internet sensation with this song, Whip It Like a Slave. And you actually put on an email that really impressed me with the critical analysis you provided in terms of the psychological, metaphoric, and actual straightforward impact this song will have upon people in the world, especially Africans and Europeans, my brother. Can you kind of break it on down? Brother Paul. Is Paul Scott on the air? How you doing, my brother? Could you kind of give us your analysis on this Lil Wayne song, Whip It Like a Slave?
Yeah, thank you for having me
for sure.
On the program again, first and foremost. Yeah, the analysis of that new song, Whip It Like a Slave, by Lil Wayne and them Franchise Boys, it's just one more example of the lack of cultural consciousness that's exhibited or not exhibited by many in the hip-hop industry. The new song, Whipping It Like a Slave, isn't really being played on the radio right now because radio right now, as far as hip-hop goes, is really passé. Most songs now are really broken on YouTube, and that's where this mindless propaganda is being played on YouTube. The song, as you played earlier, Whip It Like a Slave, is not really dealing with the enslavement of African people. It's really dealing with cooking crack. Mm-hmm. Which is a double barrel insult because you're talking about a double whammy genocide efforts against African people. So songs like that, really, we as a conscious community, conscious African community, we must speak out against that because historically what has happened is those who have spoken out against hip-hop have been the neoconservative black people, the black people who really weren't in close contact with the hip-hop community. The conscious community has failed miserably when it comes to critiquing and correcting hip-hop.
I know one of the problems I'm having these days is I happen to be an avid surfer. I'm with the Black Surfing Association. Because surfing is primarily a European sport, I go to these different beaches, and these little white kids come up to me with these little statements they pick up from YouTube and from hip-hop, which, you know, I want to hang them because they're so racist. And I'm waiting for a little cracker to come up to me and talk about whip it like a slave, thinking it's cool. And, you know, my tendency, being a very proud African man, is to want to whip him for having this kind of sultry attitude and language towards me, an elder, you know what I'm saying? And what happens is that they end up disrespecting our people because they see a Lil Wayne promoting this kind of language, promoting this kind of new form of slavery called crack cocaine epidemic, and think it's hip to judge us and view us from those, from that perspective of a Lil Wayne.
Yeah, that's why I call it propaganda. I don't even think, you know, we get into the mind state and the excuses that it's just about making money. But this is a YouTube song, basically. So it's not really about money. This is propaganda. And like you referred to earlier, many in the hip-hop generation, unfortunately, don't see the political ramifications, the long-range global political ramifications of songs like Whip It Like a Slave. It tears down the defense of white America when songs like this are played, because they're like, okay, if Lil Wayne and them Franchise Boys can make a song like that, this gives me the green light to disrespect African people. And when we don't speak out against it, when we don't raise this issue, we are condoning really our disrespect, because when they they can verbally disrespect us and put out all propaganda against us under the guise of, okay, since Lil Wayne is doing it, since them franchise boys are doing it, that automatically gives me permission to disrespect you as well. So we have to really correct that as a collective.
Well, you know, I'm sure there's so many historical precedents. I know with Public Enemy and Professor Griff and even Michael Jackson, and they made a veiled reference to Jews, how that, in fact, the Jewish religious community rose up and actually destroyed Public Enemy, had them break apart, as well as the Michael Jackson. 1.5 million CDs were shredded because he made a veiled reference to Jews and their role in Christ, the so-called role in Christ's crucifixion, and no Public Enemy. Griff made a statement about Jewry, and they rose up and defended their religious integrity. Here, songs like this can get out there on YouTube, and what is the response from our community, from the broader community?
Yeah, we are the only ones that really allow that level of disrespect. We are almost like little cowardly children. When things like that are mentioned, you mentioned earlier about the, like you just said, the original attack on hip hop that took place when hip hop was at its highest level between 1988 and 1992 against Professor Griff, against Sister Soulja, mm-hmm. against anybody who was speaking truth to power. You mentioned the Michael Jackson scenario when Michael Jackson put out, "They don't really care about us," and the line was, "Jew me, sue me." And, you know, which was basically he was talking about a political concept that, in my opinion, was no way in no way disrespectful to the Jewish community. But yet and still the most powerful person in the entertainment industry at that time was brought down to his knees based mm-hmm. on that statement, because people try to point to the fact of Michael Jackson being his alleged affairs with children being the downfall of his career. But I disagree. I think that when he made "They Don't Really Care About Us" and he had to bow down and remove it and re-record it at the height of his career, I think that is indeed the downfall of his career. So anytime any other group that's even halfway disrespected, they vehemently fight against it. But when it comes to African people being disrespected, it's almost business as usual. Because once again, the collective of the conscious community, in inception, we've made excuses for the Lil Waynes instead of correcting that behavior.
Well, my brother, we got a roll on. We're having Sister Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, who just came back from Gaza. We'd like to thank you very much. And how can people get in contact with you, Brother Paul, as well as review your analysis of contemporary hip-hop and youth culture?
Thank you once again for having me on the program. But to read my articles, just go to www.nowarningshotsfired.com. That's nowarningshotsfired.com. Hardcore news and views with a gangster attitude.
We thank you, my brother. Forward ever.
Thank you.
Take my hand.
This is Ruffy. I am 8 years old, and I don't want to live in poverty with bad policemen and politicians trying to put me in prison. Listen to KPFK's Freedom Now and help make a better world for us children. 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And on the internet at kpfk.org. Thank you. Long live Children Power!
But in the Gaza Strip now, streets are mostly empty. Fuel is running out. Hospital officials say at least 430 Palestinians have been killed, including 12-year-old Mahmoud Basrawi.
Israel's war against Hamas swept further into the Gaza Strip. Tanks surround Gaza City, still punched by artillery and airstrikes. The goal, to break Hamas's power base.
But in the Gaza Strip now, streets are mostly empty. Fuel is running out. Hospital officials say at least 430 Palestinians have been killed.
Yeah, we'd like to welcome former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, Green Party candidate Cynthia McKinney, presidential candidate, and Dignity leader Cynthia McKinney. Welcome to Southern California, my sister.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, and I would just like to commend Minister Paul Scott's website to anyone who's in the listening audience. He is absolutely right on point.
You know, you've recently had three profound experiences in Israel, in a jail in Israel, in Egypt, and in Gaza. And the goal of all of those experiences was to fight this effort to break the people of Gaza and the democratically elected government of Gaza. Can you kind of analyze, have they been successful, the Zionist, U.S., I guess in some sense, the Egyptian government power block in breaking the power base of the people of Gaza?
Well, of course, in December, right after Christmas, Israel launched its Operation Cast Lead frontal assault on the people of Gaza, 1.5 million people who are contained in an area that's roughly twice the size of Washington, D.C. Imagine if you are on, for example, Century Boulevard, and you travel for about half an hour on Century Boulevard. That's the distance that we're talking about. And within that small distance, we had F-16s raining white phosphorus, depleted uranium, munitions, cluster bombs down on the people who are trapped. And we also had helicopter gunships. We then, after that assault, then you had the Israeli army invade Gaza. And the entire world that was able to see this, thankfully to the Internet, and Al Jazeera Arabic carried it all the time, and then Press TV carried it in English all the time, and the U.S. Internet viewers were able to see this despite the blackout that occurred on CNN and other special interest media. Spontaneous demonstrations erupted all over the world against what Israel was doing, and Israel did this thanks to the U.S. taxpayer, which has provided all of this military hardware and military technology to the Israelis. So I think a lot of people heard about what happened to me in December when I tried to rush medical supplies to the people of Gaza in a boat, and the Israeli military rammed our boat, literally trying to kill all of us who were on our humanitarian mission. They rammed our boat in international waters. That is against international law. That is a war crime. Israel appears to have gotten away with it, although the Free Gaza movement is looking into legal actions, one, to replace the boat, because our boat was completely destroyed, and two, legal action against Israel for what it did that was illegal in nature. Then, just a few weeks ago, I tried to go back to Gaza again with the Free Gaza Movement by boat. While we were in international waters, again, the Israeli military approached us, but this time they actually kidnapped us. They boarded our boat, commandeered the boat, took over the steering of the boat. These Israeli ninja dressed with the black ski mask and the heavy boots and the great big huge guns and harpoons and all of everything. And then they incarcerated us. They took us into custody. Instead of taking us to Gaza, which was our destination, we went through a very circuitous route, an additional 7 hours trip to Ashdod Port in Israel, where we were taken into custody by the Israeli military and then incarcerated for 7 days in an Israeli prison. I finally, after that experience, I still wanted to get to Gaza to see what my country had allowed to take place. And of course, during this entire time, President Obama, no one from the Obama administration said anything about what was happening to the Palestinian people. And George Galloway had come to the United States and organized a Viva Palestina USA convoy, similar to the Viva Palestina UK convoy that he organized, that made it into Gaza successfully in March of this year, right after Operation Cast Lead ended. He called and invited me to come to Egypt, where they had been for the 11 days waiting for the Egyptians to say, yes, you can go into Gaza. And eventually the permission came. It was with great difficulty, and the Egyptian government stalled the entire time, but they gave us 24 hours to go to Gaza, and I was able to see the utter, complete, sheer devastation and, in my opinion, the genocide of a people. Now, what is interesting is that there are so many people who are now speaking out about what Israel is doing, particularly in Palestine, but in the West Bank as well with the settlements. And this spurious accusation of anti-Semitism has arisen, so that any problem that anyone has with the conduct of the Israeli government is now put through this prism of this person is anti-Semitic. And this is quite insulting, because what we have witnessed is an increasing chorus line from Jews who are anti-Zionist, who are taking a stand against the actions of Israel.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, and I apologize. Our discussion with Sister Kareem took a little longer. But what can we do as progressives, as people who believe in the humanity of the Palestinians, as opposed to the Zionist notion that they're the dregs of society? What can we do to support the Palestinian struggle?
I think, first of all, people have to inform themselves. And there are lots of places where one can do that. We have the Dignity website, dignity.ning.com, which I would invite people to visit and join in that social community. We also are on Twitter, and we are on Facebook. So I would invite people to join us that way as we send out information. There's also information that's available at the freegaza.org website. And I am in the process, literally right now, of uploading the video and the photographs that I took while I was there. And people will be able to see what has been done to the people of Gaza with the help of the U.S. taxpayer. Now, instead of sending money to Israel for their military machine, I think the people of the United States need that money. Mm-hmm. And the United States certainly has more to give to the world than soldiers, weapons, bombs, missiles, and military bases, as is being done now, even under the Obama administration in Colombia and other, in Haiti and other places around the world. So once one educates oneself on what the situation is, then I think it's important that we communicate what our values are to the White House, and then we vote our values instead of voting from habit.
Well, my sister, we thank you very much, and of course, we will continue to cover the crisis in Middle East, and you will be one of our major correspondents as well as activists in terms of the excellent work you're doing on behalf of the people of Palestine, but more importantly, on your behalf of African people and all progressive people. We thank you very much, my sister.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank Brother Darren, Jose, Brother Malcolm, Sister Rissa, Brother Matef, Sister Kareem El Amin, Brother Obi Egbuna, Paul Scott, and of course, former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney for their contribution to our program tonight. Tonight's program will be heard for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Under Audio Archives, scroll to Freedom Now. And if you want to contact us or look at prior programs, go to kpfk.org. Go to Programs, and you'll see the list of the programs we've done for the last couple of years. And if you want to contact us, call us at 323-646-4814. Information about the guests will be posted on our website tonight. And as always, we stand ready for the revolution.
You've been listening to Freedom Now on KPFK, celebrating 50 years of broadcasting, 50 years of being powered by the people. Stay tuned here at KPFK Spanish Language Programming, coming up next.
Hello, I'm Don Bastani, host of Middle East in Focus. Millions and millions of words have been spoken here at KPFK about the Middle East conflict and the struggle for a resolution. But we don't see much progress on the ground. The Israeli occupation continues, confiscation of Palestinian land continues, and American presidents continue to look the other way. But every week, more and more people are learning the